Hello and welcome to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll feature a truth track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week's truth track is titled NAB, the National Association of Bastards. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. Studies confirm that long medical internships may contribute to medical error. A pilot's union accepts pay cuts from U.S. Airways. Book lovers petition Congress to oppose the USA Patriot Act. Lawmakers and a judge deem current campaign finance regulations lacking. And despite big government gigs, Halliburton posts losses. Medical school interns routinely work 30-hour shifts, but two new studies say the workload is both dangerous and excessive and are calling for interns' hours to be cut in half. The year-long studies, conducted at Brigham and Women's Hospital and released by the Harvard Medical School, measured how sleep affects job performance. Christopher Landrigan, the Brigham and Women's Hospital director of the Sleep and Patient Safety Program and lead researcher for one of the studies, found that interns working average-length shifts make 36% more serious medical errors and 5 times more serious diagnostic errors than interns working a maximum of 16 hours per shift. Medical residents are not allowed to work more than 80 hours a week or more than 30 hours per shift, according to educational guidelines put in effect last July. However, interns continue to work longer shifts, despite the rules. Harvard Medical School instructor Stephen Lockley told the Harvard Crimson that the average work shift is about 32 hours. Federal laws restrict the length of shifts in other professions, like truck driving. No such laws regulate medical interns. A 1999 study by the Institute of Medicine found that medical errors are the 8th leading cause of death in the United States. Pilots at U.S. Airways narrowly approved $300 million in wage and benefits cuts, making the Airline Pilots Association the first major union representing U.S. Airways workers to agree to permanent concessions. The airline, which filed for bankruptcy in September, received approval to enact emergency pay cuts from U.S. bankruptcy court in October. By voting for permanent cuts, the pilots will not be subject to the 21% emergency temporary pay cut. Instead, they will receive a permanent 18% pay cut. U.S. Airways will also eliminate health care benefits for pilots after they retire, increase the number of hours pilots are required to fly each month, and reduce the company's contribution to pilots' retirement plan. The vote was contentious, with pilots in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia speaking out against accepting the permanent cuts. Union leaders there argued that the cuts in retirement benefits were too severe, especially since they had already been cut when U.S. Airways filed bankruptcy for the first time 2 years ago. Other union leaders said they had little choice and that any future contracts would likely have been even worse. A coalition of bookstore customers sent a petition signed by 180,000 people to Congress, complaining that the Patriot Act jeopardizes their privacy. The petition, presented by representatives of the American Booksellers Association, the Association of American Publishers, Penn American Center, and the American Library Association, focuses on Section 215 of the controversial act created in the wake of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Section 215 gives the FBI unprecedented access to library and book purchase records and imposes a so-called gag order on bookstore or library staff, forbidding them to reveal to anyone that an investigation is underway. Lawmakers in favor of campaign finance reform introduced new legislation in September in another attempt to keep corporations, unions, and the wealthy from influencing political elections. The bill would require the controversial 527s, a class of nonprofit organization named after the tax code that governs them, to register as political committees and submit to FEC, Federal Election Commission, regulations on their fundraising and spending. The bill's drafters, Senators John McCain, Republican of Arizona, and Russell Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, and Representatives Martin Meehan, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Christopher Shays, Republican of Connecticut, have been working for years to place restrictions on campaign funding sources. The growth of 527s has met mixed reactions from the public and political leaders. Many see the organizations as positive forces for political change, while others have accused them of circumventing campaign finance reform by taking advantage of loopholes created by the FEC. In September, a federal judge ruled that several FEC regulations developed in the wake of the original McCain-Feingold campaign funding bill, including those that govern 527s, do not uphold the spirit of that law. In a move that clouded her decision with uncertainty, U.S. District Judge Colleen Collar-Cotelli sent the rules back to the FEC for revision, instead of throwing them out altogether. As a result, the validity of the current rules is unclear. Most organizations and campaigns, however, have stated that they take Collar-Cotelli's ruling to mean that the regulations remain the same until new rules are drafted. Most experts expect that neither Collar-Cotelli's decision nor the proposed legislation will affect the 2004 campaign. The U.S.-based transnational conglomerate Halliburton received over 40% of its fourth-quarter revenue from massive U.S. government contracts in Iraq, yet still posted a net loss for the period, largely as a result of findings against the company's labor practices. Bloomberg reported that Halliburton, the oil and construction firm formerly headed by Dick Cheney and with close ties to the Bush administration, made over $2 billion in the fourth quarter of 2003 from construction contracts for Iraqi oil fields and contracts providing services to the U.S. occupation forces in Iraq. However, those contracts were not enough to stop the company posting a $947 million net loss in the fourth quarter. Bloomberg reported that the company blamed its losses on massive payouts for domestic occupational health and safety abuses. It was noted that $1.1 billion was most recently paid by the parent company as part of its asbestos settlements, which the Guardian of London estimated to total around $4.5 billion. Many of these charges revolve around Dresser Industries Incorporated, a Halliburton subsidiary which has faced asbestos-related damages claims dating back to the 1970s. The Los Angeles Times reported that thousands of workers developed lung cancer and respiratory diseases from being exposed to asbestos at work. The industry publication Insurance Journal says Halliburton has attempted to dodge payment of the settlements in various ways, including filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy for the liable subsidiaries. The LA Times also reported that a July 2003 proposal by Congress to create a national fund for asbestos victims was actively supported by Halliburton, which stood to save over $3.5 billion from the plan. The acquisition of Dresser Industries by Halliburton around 4 years ago was described by the New York Times as the high point of Mr. Cheney's five-year Halliburton career. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Henry David Thoreau said that there are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root. ReclaimDemocracy.org is striking at the deepest root of today's problems, runaway corporate power. We focus on proactive structural change to restore citizen authority over corporations and return them to their legitimate role, doing business and nothing more. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. On today's show, we'll feature a truth track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week, the topic is NAB, the National Association of Bastards. There is an industry lobby in Washington perhaps more powerful than all others. No more coveted, feared, loved, or hated lobby exists. In 2003, they held assets of more than $66 million and rake in another $50 million through its assorted dues, sales, and activities. They own their own building in downtown Washington and have an annual payroll of $12.5 million. They donate $2.2 million to candidates for federal office, nearly two-thirds to Republicans. The cash buys a lot, like appointment recommendations to relevant government regulatory agencies, which then make decisions which benefit the lobby and keep the money flowing. And perhaps the most glaring sign of their power is most Americans don't even know their name. You shouldn't expect the media to critically examine or expose this lobby anytime soon. That's because this lobby is the media. We're talking about the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters. The NAB is the trade association representing the interests of for-profit over-the-air radio and television broadcasters. The group was founded in 1923 here in Chicago at the Drake Hotel downtown. Their first main victory was in the establishment of a commercial radio system in the United States, with the deal sealed by the Communications Act of 1934. The NAB fought a coalition of educators, nonprofit broadcasters, labor unions, and religious groups, which fought in the 1920s and 1930s to establish a public, nonprofit, license-funded radio system without commercials, much like what was established in Britain with the BBC. But the NAB won, and unlike practically every other country in the world, they made sacrosanct in the US the commercialization of media in radio and in nearly every other broadcast technology since introduced. The group muzzles out attempts at reform which might change the commercial orientation of most U.S. radio and TV broadcasting, or even impact the profits of for-profit broadcasters. With regards to campaigns to run for public office, the NAB donates money to candidates who don't overturn or even rock the money boat, and unlike any other lobby, also controls the spigot of giving broadcast airtime to candidates who don't overturn or rock the money boat. They make threats to elected officials who show even the slightest sign of dissent or even criticism. Gloria Tristani was a member of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, who supported the creation of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of low-power FM radio stations for local communities across the U.S., but who in 2002 was also running for Senate in New Mexico. The NAB opposed, and still opposes, low-power FM, since it would present a low-cost, non-commercial alternative to commercial radio. The NAB threatened Tristani twice with denial of airtime and gave money to her opponent. Tristani followed her conscience anyway and paid for it by losing the race for Senate. Former Senator Bob Dole, a Republican, during the same year he ran for president, criticized the giveaway of the digital spectrum to for-profit broadcasters, totaling a then estimated $70 billion. Dole immediately stopped his criticism when he was lobbied by the NAB. The NAB wields power like no other lobby, and as a result, corruption is rampant with many NAB players. They break the rules, then lobby to have the rules changed, then they break the new rules. And we have a sterling example here in Chicago with the Tribune Company. The Tribune's vice president, Sean Sheehan, worked as an NAB lobbyist for nearly two decades, and the Tribune has lobbied hard in recent years to have the FCC's cross-ownership rule eliminated. This is the rule which prevents a single company from owning a TV station and a newspaper in a single city or regional area. You would be hard-pressed to read the Tribune or watch WGN to learn that the Tribune would profit handsomely if this rule were repealed. By the way, the Tribune Company currently owns TV stations and newspapers in New York, Los Angeles, South Florida, and Hartford, Connecticut, and is thus breaking the law in all of these cities. Key government regulators often wind up working for the NAB. Example, FCC Chair Michael Powell's Chief of Staff, Marsh McBride, joined the NAB as its head of legal and regulatory affairs. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the NAB was the leading sponsor of free trips given to FCC officials. The head of the Center for Public Integrity, Charles Lewis, a journalist, remarked, "Who's going to report about this? The media?" To be sure, the NAB dominates a rigged game, and as a result, to quote media scholar and activist Robert McChesney, the NAB is a group which has a special place in hell. The future for social justice and popular activism efforts across the board requires structurally reforming the media, which reports on them and thus limits their future prospects. And changing the media would require defanging the NAB. This might sound like a daunting, near impossible task, but the NAB is a political vampire. The more the cronies at the NAB are exposed to the light of day, the more that people realize the corruption of media policy and the greater the likelihood of defeating the NAB. The NAB's strength hinges greatly on people's ignorance about it. In general, people thinking that media policy is something inevitable like gravity. But when this veil of ignorance is lifted, when people understand their rights to have a say in shaping our media, the prospects for change improve dramatically. And this is exactly what has happened and what is happening. The NAB has seen a challenge in recent years unlike any it has seen in the past 50 years. Since 2002, a grassroots organizing movement focused on media and the NAB, largely galvanized over the internet, helped stop efforts to repeal much of the current rules of media ownership limits. These efforts helped to expand to bring the public into media policy debates and resurrect long-dead popular media proposals like the aforementioned expansion of low-power FM radio licenses. Efforts are underway to organize locally and nationally against the NAB and corrupt media policy generally. On a local basis, the group Chicago Media Action, for whom this reporter is a part, works on media issues. You can find them online at chicagomediaaction.org or call them toll-free at 1-866-260-7198. That's 866-260-7198. On a national level, the group Free Press is also working on popular organizing around media issues in the NAB. You can visit them online at freepress.net or call 866-666-1533. That's 866-666-1533. And remember, the NAB isn't the National Association of Broadcasters, they're the National Association of Bastards. This concludes this Truth Track. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.